Good evening. Protests rock Iraq as thousands take to the streets to be met by bullets. North Korea pulls out of peace talks with the U.S. over denuclearization and the overnight murders of four homeless men in Chinatown. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Saturday, October 5th, 2019. Clashes between police and protesters killed 11 people in Baghdad on Saturday in a new flare-up of anti-government unrest as security forces deployed in their hundreds to keep demonstrations away from central squares in the Iraqi capital. Police and medical sources reported that casualties after days of violence around anti-government protests, bringing the toll in Baghdad and other cities this week to at least 88. The unrest is the deadliest Iraq has seen since the declared defeat of Islamic State in 2017 and a shaken Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi's year-old government. Reuters reports that in eastern Baghdad, police snipers shot at demonstrators and several people were wounded on Friday and Saturday. Iraq's semi-official High Commission for Human Rights, in unverified figures, put the toll at 94 dead since protests broke out on Tuesday. Security services said the violence killed eight members of the security forces and wounded more than 1,000. According to police, at least 18 people were killed during the week in the southern city of Nasiriyah, where police fired live rounds at demonstrators and protesters torched the headquarters of several political parties in the city. These included the headquarters of the powerful Dawa Party that dominated Iraq's government from 2003 until the 2018 elections. Khoury Peterson-Smith is Middle East specialist for the Institute for Policy Studies. He says the problem in Iraq is not limited to that country and are rooted in the U.S. invasion of that country.
Really, to understand this and the kind of corruption that that Iraqis are protesting, we have to understand what has transpired in Iraq since the U.S. invasion in 2003, which not only involved a U.S. invasion and this incredible divide and rule of the population across sectarian lines, but also really installing laying the foundation for all kinds of corruption in the government. And since then, the United States, even though its military presence is much smaller in Iraq, the amount of security assistance and military aid that the U.S. has given to Iraq is incredible. It's given many billions in military aid over the years, over $16 billion in aid since 2005, just in terms of military kind of security assistance.
If Iraq and Iran are allied at this time and the United States is fighting basically with Iran, then we're giving billions to Iraq. Isn't that a bit self-defeating, or am I not looking at it right?
To understand that situation, we have to go back to what the U.S. was hoping to do with the launch of what they call the War on Terror and the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 in particular. And the idea was really to reshape the Middle East and try to isolate Iran. And, you know, folks will remember that actually John Bolton and others said, were quite clear that the plan was not to stop in Iraq, but that the U.S. would have a successful invasion of Iraq and then go on to invade Iran. And that has not only has that not worked out, but in fact, yeah, the Iraqi government has become quite close with the Iranian government in that their forces in Iraq that are allied with Iran. And so there is this situation that the United States has had to accept because it really has not been able to get its way. So it is this complicated and contradictory situation. I think that what Iraqis are showing us is very clarifying. You know, this is, you know, we can look at Iraq, the country. We can also look at the region, where throughout the region there's been this incredible heroic kind of mass protest. Folks remember the Arab Spring in 2011, in which we saw some protests in Iraq, but not on the scale that we saw elsewhere in the region. Subsequently, there have been mass waves of protests in Iraq. Both in 2016 was a huge wave in which people actually stormed the parliament, among other things. And this current wave of protests actually seems to be even more widespread, with more bitterness toward the whole political class and the generalized kind of corruption in the country. And again, the United States has a great deal to do with that corruption, as well as the repression that Iraqis are facing now. These are the weapons that the state is using to repress them were supplied by the United States. So this is something that we should be concerned, because this is an Iraqi fight for freedom in this country. And we should be concerned because, once again, the United States is on the wrong side. The United States, in many ways, has laid the foundation has played a big role in laying the foundation for what Iraqis are protesting against.
What do they want? What do Iraqis want out of this?
There's a number of things. So the government's incredibly corrupt. The economic situation is a nightmare, despite the fact that there's a tremendous amount of U.S. aid going to Iraq, despite the fact there's an incredible amount, of course, of oil wealth and other wealth in Iraq. And we've actually seen an increase in oil production in recent years. Most Iraqis are not seeing any of that that wealth for themselves, and so the economy remains very bad. And so, again, there are things that are specific to Iraq that people are protesting, and there's a particular situation of corruption that people really resent. But this does kind of resonate with what's happening throughout the region, where people are really struggling to get by economically and facing these very repressive states, and Iraq is no exception to that. So, again, people want jobs, people want a stable society and country, and people want an end to the corruption. And then this thing is in motion, and frankly, the repression is fueling it. And so we will see what develops as Iraqis, more and more Iraqis get involved and fight for a different direction for their society.
Corey Peterson-Smith is Middle East Specialist for the Institute for Policy Studies. North Korea's top negotiator said late on Saturday that working-level nuclear talks in Sweden between officials from Pyongyang and Washington had been broken off, dashing prospects for an end to months of stalemate. The North's chief nuclear negotiator cast the blame on what he portrayed as U.S. inflexibility. There was no immediate response from the U.S. side. Swedish broadcaster TV4 reported U.S. Special Representative for North Korea, Stephen Biegun, who led the U.S. team, had arrived back in the country's embassy in central Stockholm. Women Cross the DMZ is a peace movement that links women on both sides of the militarized border between North and South Korea. Its executive director is Christine Ahn. She says a dangerous situation is being made worse by chaos in the White House.
Things are at a very serious impasse. Since talks broke down in Hanoi 7 months ago, it appeared that the U.S. were ready to come back to talks with a fundamentally different approach. And I think that set pretty high expectations from the North Koreans that the U.S. was committed to transforming the U.S.-North Korea relationship. But it seems as if they are still singularly focused on denuclearization. And that just won't work. We cannot expect North Korea to unilaterally disarm, given the history of the Korean War, given the fact that we destroyed 80% of that country, and given what we have done to other countries, such as Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere, we have to change the relationship. And the unfortunate thing is that to achieve denuclearization requires peace. And the North and the South Koreans, as we know, a year ago, Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, and Kim Jong-un had met. They signed two major declarations in both Panmunjom at the DMZ and also in Pyongyang, where they set forth a really radical transformative process to achieve peace and to end war. And unfortunately, the U.S.-North Korea talks being stalled, U.S. being so obsessed with denuclearization without recognizing that peace and normalization must come first, more in a step-by-step approach, has really delayed that peace process between North and South Korea. So it's a huge loss, and I'm not sure what happened, but we have to hear what the U.S. side says. But unfortunately, there's a part of me that's not surprised, given the kind of closed-mindedness and belief that further strangling North Korea is going to achieve denuclearization. It just won't work.
John Bolton, national security advisor, known as a hardliner and a hawk, he's left. That hasn't changed anything. Pompeo's continuing the same kind of bellicose policies. And whatever happened to Donald Trump and all of this?
That's a very good question. I think that's why the North Koreans also felt that, John Bolton and Trump getting rid of him. He was obviously a huge obstacle. He has a long history of not liking any kind of agreement and has been the one that has the most successful agreement that the U.S. negotiated with North Korea in 1994 during the Clinton administration was the agreed framework that froze North Korea's nuclear weapons program. It began the process of totally eliminating it. And unfortunately, John Bolton, as soon as Bush and the Axis of Evil came into power, he was quick to completely do away with it. So we thought that with him out of the picture, there was actually the possibility Stephen Biegun, who our delegation has met with and has stayed in communication with, we had hoped that he understood the need for a pragmatic step-by-step approach. I'm not sure what's going on. Clearly, the administration is in total chaos, especially with everybody focused on impeachment and Donald Trump clearly losing it even more. And so who knows what's going on in that circus of that administration. It is a huge missed opportunity. Our sense was that Trump viewed a breakthrough with North Korea as an important diplomatic win that is good for the United States. Whether it's negotiated in a Republican or a Democratic administration, it is a win for the United States. It's a win for Americans because this is the longest standing U.S. conflict. It has been 70 years. It has set forth the military-industrial complex. It has led to unnecessary militarization of the peninsula, of the region. And it's time to have a new chapter. And Korea is a very easy lift. Korean people want an end to the war. The leaders have expressed the will of the people. 8 out of 10 South Koreans want there to be a peace agreement to end the war. This is something that our allies in the region want. And so I really hope that something can be done soon because we are running out of time. You may recall, Kim Jong-un said that they have set the timetable. And as we saw, the submarine launch, it wasn't a long-range missile, but they are clearly advancing their capability, and it's sending a message to the United States. We're ready to negotiate with you, but we are not going to concede to a unilateral disarmament.
And that was Christine Ahn, the executive director of Women Cross the DMZ. Only a day after announcing the new talks, North Korea said it had test-fired a new ballistic missile designed for submarine launch. But U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says he's hopeful of progress in these talks. And British police arrested 10 climate change activists in London ahead of a planned new round of protests by Extinction Rebellion on Monday. Reportedly, police used a battering ram to break down a door and enter a former court building that was used by the group Extinction Rebellion to store equipment. A spokeswoman for London's Metropolitan Police said 7 women and 3 men had been arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to cause public nuisance. Extinction Rebellion said the arrests represented an escalation of preemptive tactics by the government and police and was a sign that it was considered a significant movement by the authorities. The group staged 11 days of protests in London in April that disrupted public transportation and roads. On Thursday, Extinction Rebellion activists used a fire engine to hose red liquid at the British Finance Ministry's headquarters in London to draw attention to what they said was the government's failure to avert climate disaster. Extinction Rebellion says it plans to bring roads around Westminster, the government center of London, to a standstill with tens of thousands of protesters and stage a sit-in at City Airport in London as part of environmental demonstrations in the next fortnight. That's 2 weeks. It will be part of an international rebellion calling for urgent action on climate change and the dying out of endangered species. Meanwhile, in New York, Extinction Rebellion is planning what they tout as global extinction rebellion on Monday, October 7th and Sunday, October 13th in Battery Park. The group, which advocates nonviolent civil disobedience in support of the environment, says the actions are part of a global rebellion to rise up and fight for our lives. On Saturday, climate activists in France entered and blocked the Paris shopping mall, but by 9 p.m., masked police using hydraulic pistons forced open steel shutters protesters used as barricades. Hundreds of protesters from the same group, Extinction Rebellion, they're busy across the world, mingled with some members of the Yellow Vest movement that had entered the mall in the south of France capital Saturday morning. in the south of the French capital on Wednesday morning. Shops closed as demonstrators locked the mall doors and barricaded themselves inside. Banners were deployed, some saying radical ecology, death to capitalism. At one point, officers attempting to enter through a small side door were pushed back by protesters armed with mall furniture. Unable to enter, the officers doused the crowd in pepper spray and threw back projectiles. Another shopping center was occupied in Bordeaux in the southwest of the country as the protesters announced a two-week-long action targeting the symbols of capitalism. Must be the same fortnight that we were talking about earlier. And American and NATO flags were burned in the streets of Athens Saturday as thousands of people demonstrated against U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's visit to Greece. Pompeo is negotiating a mutual defense agreement with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, its NATO ally Greece, on the last leg of his four-nation European tour. A statue of U.S. President Harry Truman was vandalized with red paint. The protesters say they are anti-imperialists, opposed to renewal of the Greece-U.S. Mutual Defense Corps Cooperation Agreement. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In local news, New York City police say four apparently homeless men were killed in Manhattan by an assailant wielding a 3-foot-long metal pipe thought to be from a construction site. The attacks were carried out while the victims were asleep. A fifth person was hospitalized with critical injuries. Speaking at a press conference Saturday morning, Deputy Chief Inspector Michael Baldassano said a 24-year-old male person of interest who is also homeless is in custody. He said the attacks appeared to be random rather than motivated by race or age. This is his superior, another officer speaking at the beginning of the press conference by the NYPD.
The information we're about to provide is preliminary and subject to change as the investigation continues. Presently, a 24-year-old male person of interest is in custody in connection with the death of four males and serious assault of the fifth male victim. Today at 1:49 a.m., officers from the 5th Precinct received a 911 call for a person being assaulted in the vicinity of 2 Bowery. When the responding officers arrived at the location, they discovered an unconscious male lying in the street with severe head trauma. A second male with head trauma also approached the officers at the scene. Two witnesses informed the responding officers that an unknown male wearing a black jacket and black pants struck the victim numerous times in the head with a metal object and then was observed fleeing westbound on Doyer Street. Officers immediately began canvassing the area for the suspect, and at Mulberry Street and Canal Street, a male fitting description was observed carrying the metal object. The officers placed that male in custody and recovered the metal object without further incident. An expanded search of the area revealed three additional victims, two in front of 2 East Broadway and one in front of 17 East Broadway. The three males on East Broadway had severe head trauma and were pronounced deceased at the scene. The one male at 2 Bowery was pronounced deceased at the scene. The second male at 2 Bowery was transported to Cornell Hospital in critical condition. Presently, a crime scene is established at Bowery East Broadway. The NYPD is conducting a street-by-street canvas for any additional victims. And we request anybody with information in regards to this incident is to ask to call out NYPD Crime Stoppers hotline at 1-800-577-TIPS. I'll turn it over to Deputy Chief Michael Baldassano, who is conducting an investigation.
Activists say the brutal attacks were no surprise, with homeless individuals in the street, the fastest growing group of homeless people in the city, with more than 60,000 homeless. Paulette Sultanas is political director of the activist group Vocal New York. She says the government could do better in housing homeless people.
We have to call it what it is, which is a failure, a political failure, a policy failure, a moral failure on behalf of Governor Cuomo and the mayor for allowing our homelessness crisis to exist for as long as they have. I mean, they are responsible for doing so much more and could be doing so much more to stop homelessness, to stop street homelessness, to aid in giving people the resources they need for mental health or for health conditions, period. And so this is a preventable attack and never should have happened.
they always play down. They want to talk about the families in the shelters and the numbers of people who children who are in shelters. And they seem to always shy away from talking about homeless men on the street. Is there a sort of a discrimination towards these people as somehow less deserving?
You can look at the data and see that the fastest, the rising population becoming homeless at the fastest pace is single adults across the city. And so to, for the city not to be using its resources to kind of confront that problem head on is obviously misguided. And yes, the majority of people that are living on the street are single adults. And I think that that's a proof that policy, like that they're not using the resources the way that they should be in order to get people off the streets and into safe places and then permanent housing.
What needs to be done? What is the city not doing that needs to be done?
Mayor de Blasio committed 15,000 units of supportive housing. And as you know, this is housing paired with permanent housing paired with supportive services for people with different health needs. And so of the 15,000 units of housing, very, very little has actually been completed and those units are not occupied. I mean, the majority of the units haven't been completed. And number one is the fact that there's not enough supportive housing out there for folks. And then number two is you look at his affordable housing plan, and it's another piece of evidence that he's not actually using city resources to target the people that need the most help. And so out of 300,000 units of affordable housing, only 15,000 units are being set aside for homeless people. We have a crisis of well over 60,000 people who are homeless, and that's both in the shelter and on the streets. And the most basic way to target the issue of homelessness is to provide housing for people. And if you're not doing that, then you're failing.
Is this also a problem with the state and federal government? This is something with the capitalistic system that there's always going to be an underclass in society. And how can you address that?
It doesn't have to be that way. That's the issue, is that real estate doesn't need to buy our government. Real estate doesn't need to own our politicians' decisions. What we have seen is that's what's happening under Governor Cuomo. I mean, he cares more about the real estate industry than he cares about New Yorkers. And what he's done is even worse than the mayor's reputation around the housing crisis, because he hasn't done anything. I mean, he's all but abandoned his own commitments around supportive housing and the creation of affordable housing across the state. And you can't really even point to what he's done over the years that he's been in office. This crisis, this homelessness crisis, does not need to exist. It is the scope of this crisis could be reduced if we had people in office that reprioritize the resources that we have in government to target this. This is an emergency. I mean, this is proof. What happened last night is proof that this is really a state of emergency. People's lives are at stake. People are dying. This is not the first time that we've heard of horrific attacks like this. Just last week, a woman was stabbed in her shelter here in New York City. And so until we get people into stable housing, these risks will continue to exist and interact with all of the other things that people have going on, including mental health, including substance use. We should be housing people first. And we know that our government, the city and the state of New York have the resources to do the right thing. Now it's just going to take the political will for these two leaders to actually step in the path of doing that.
Paulette Soltanis is political director of the activist group Vocal New York. And finally, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is leaving Las Vegas and returning home to Vermont after being treated for a heart attack. The 78-year-old boarded a plane Saturday, just one day after he was released from a hospital. Sanders was at a campaign event Tuesday when he experienced chest discomfort and was taken to a hospital. Sanders' campaign released a statement from his doctor saying that two stents were inserted to open up a blocked artery in his heart. They say the rest of his arteries were normal. The doctor said the rest of his stay was uneventful with good expected progress.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
And that's some of the news for Saturday, October 5th, 2019. The WBAI Evening News was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is James Irsay. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
I turn my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night.
Coming up in a few minutes, we have the Laura's Flanders Show at the 6:30 mark.
And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did disturb the sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words, like silent raindrops, fell. The people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispering. Silence.